You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Brad Loncar, Bruce Booth, Dawn Bell, and I'm also happy to welcome a new co-host today, Paul Matisse. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So let's start with market sentiment and the current bear market in biotech. Josh and Paul, what are you hearing, seeing from investors?
I can start and then let Josh chime in. I mean, I think we're at a point now in this market where I don't even feel like most investors I talk to are fundamentally bearish on things like valuations, or, you know, bearish that we're on the cusp of a bunch of clinical data failures or FDA risk or all those things like that. I almost feel like the bearishness in the market's become more psychological, where people are looking towards catalysts and worried, am I going to get paid? You know, what does the stock do if the company needs to raise capital on the back of it? Or conversely, could things overshoot on the downside beyond whatever I think the kind of fundamental value is? And so I think into the end of this year, I'm just seeing a lot of people trying to play defense. And there's sort of hope that if we get into a calendar year reset, if we get the macro environment to stabilize, not rates go down, but just kind of find a kind of flattening that you can sort of recalibrate. But, you know, right now in my conversations, it just feels like there's a lot of risk aversion. And even as valuations are cheaper, a lot of struggle with what is the sort of right stock to own right now, what's actually going to work.
Hey, Paul, how do you think of the calendar year reset in the context of the calendar year coming up as an election year?
It's a great question. I mean, it feels like in all the past election years and in recent history, biotech's been a bit of a punching bag, right? I mean, it's become now more bipartisan than ever to sort of, you know, vilify things like drug pricing. I mean, I think the hope is that, you know, a lot's already happened, right? Like, we have the IRA. Yes, there are certain new things that are, you know, on the fringe that continue to be proposed that are more extreme. But I think the hope is that this is not going to be the headlining issue this time, like it is before. But it's probably enough to kind of continue to scare off, you know, more generalists in the space. But as it relates to the specialists, I mean, I think the view is, you know, we've got the IRA. There's nothing else that's super scary that is imminent. Certainly could be wrong, but I haven't heard about that as much as I have in kind of prior election cycles. If we think back to the famous Hillary tweet from 8 or so years ago.
But in terms of macro, do you think there's any impact there that could be better or worse for us?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? Like, I mean, I think, honestly, I feel like when investors are looking at the macro environment right now, they're looking much more at the Fed than they are, you know, looking at a certain political party that's more or less favorable. I mean, we can think about the obvious things like taxes, right, and how that impacts margins and models. But I think on the politics side, it's just less of a focus. It's really more on the Fed and, you know, what does the economy look like and how is that going to kind of change motivations near term?
Super helpful. Thanks.
To the team, we lost Josh. If you can get him back on, he says he can't dial back in. So actually, related to policy, this week, Bio had a board meeting in DC, and they used the opportunity to have me and other board members meet with senators and congressmen to talk about some biotech-related legislation being advanced. There were 40 meetings, and this was actually all taking place in the backdrop of a new speaker being voted on, so it was an exciting day. I have to say, I came away very encouraged, actually, by a few things. The first is that there are some near-term fixes to issues that the industry's been worried about. The second is that there's bipartisan support for the bills that propose these fixes. And I actually felt like the third takeaway is that, at least in the meetings I was in, there seemed to be acknowledgement of the role of, you know, small biotechs and job creation and innovation and more scrutiny on PBMs. In fact, there are a few bills in the works, including the bipartisan Lower Cost, More Transparency Act, which is H.R. 5378. And that helps to rein in egregious practices of PBMs by requiring them to disclose drug rebates and discounts. So I thought that's one positive. I've heard there's others moving through. On the IRA, a specific bill where there's a lot of support is the Orphan Cures Act. And as you'll recall, in the IRA, orphan drugs are excluded from Medicare price negotiations. However, this exemption only applies to drugs that treat a single rare disease, and the negotiation clock started running even if you were operating under the exclusion. So this Orphan Cures Act would restore the incentives in two ways. It would amend the IRA to ensure orphan drugs treated that are treating one or more rare diseases are excluded from price negotiations as long as all indications are orphan. So you can do multiple orphan. The legislation also would make the countdown to eligibility for IRA price negotiation begin only when an orphan drug loses its exclusion. So this addresses what's really an unintended consequence of developers delaying market entry until they have a broader label, which is a really big deal in oncology since you often start with the smallest population and work backward. So I actually want to put a call to action. The bill has bipartisan sponsors in the House and Senate, and what biotech folks can do is contact their representatives and ask them to join as co-sponsors. Another side note is that there's similar work going on in an attempt to change the small molecule timeline from 9 to 13 years, which is obviously a huge issue and been one that we've been talking about. Do you guys want to hear? There's some other, I think, areas that are pretty important for biotech that haven't been discussed as much. Do you guys want to hear some more about those?
Yes.
Okay, so some other areas include R&D tax credits and net operating losses. So we're actually a cash-generating biotech. I can tell you how painful it is to be paying taxes. Right now, if a biotech, any biotech, even like a loss-making biotech, gets an upfront payment from a deal, they may have to pay taxes even if they're loss-making because now you can't deduct R&D in 1 year. You have to amortize it over 5 years. Also, if you're a biotech that has had a significant ownership change, your ability to access net operating losses is severely limited. So given the difficult financing environment, you really don't want a financing or even a merger of equals or some other transaction to make it so you can't access your losses. So there's two, there's a number of bills actually. They're all called American Innovation. And one is R&D Competitiveness, another one is American Innovation Jobs Act, and another one is also called the American Innovation Act, but they're set up to address these issues, the R&D tax credit and NOLs. And then the other thing I was hearing about is on FTC. There aren't any big legislative proposals moving, but since the agency backed down on the Amgen-Horizon merger, the temperature on that issue has gone down a lot. What we're hearing is that all eyes are going to be on Pfizer, Seagen now. There's an assumption that since they've been quiet so far, most people think that this gets settled in the Q1 of 2024. But we'll see if FTC has learned any lessons after they've had a string of tough losses, including some which were outside of our sector. So overall, I came away really encouraged by all of these meetings.
Sounds like the investor sentiment, Daphne, on kind of IRA and it just being futile might be overly pessimistic.
That's really what my impression was after that. I have to say sentiment towards biotech. I thought everybody hated us. And, you know, it seems actually a lot more positive. And I think it's kind of turning towards people sort of focusing on PBMs. So Brad Stiefel shared a list of all the biotech companies who have publicly stated they're exploring strategic alternatives. And there was at least 30 companies on that list. Did you take a look at the list and what did you think about those companies or just in general the sentiment?
Yeah, it's actually up to 45. I mean, it's, you know, it's things are rough out there. I mean, it's I don't know what more you can say about it. There's one thing that's interesting is that a couple of big companies have been on that list lately. GW was like the latest addition. So, you know, that's an over 10 billion company. So that's over 10 billion. But other than that, it's mostly just these like negative enterprise or very low enterprise value companies. And I think just a lot of small companies out there realize that the funding environment is going to be tough for a while. And so to be able to raise, you know, during good times, you could always pivot. If you had a program that blew up, you could always change your story and raise money for the most part. And that's impossible right now. And companies are realizing that. And so they're doing this, and in many cases it's, you know, for reverse merger purposes, which there's huge demand for. But yeah, it's just kind of a sign of how rough it is out there.
Yeah. Bruce, I saw that you were part of a $245 million Series A, Aeolios, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Bio, second largest A round of 2023. So what can you say about that one?
Yeah, and pronouncing the name is something that we're all struggling with as well. So I won't even attempt. But look, it's a shot at a best-in-class TSLP program for severe asthma. The team sort of identified this asset out of China, and it's the idea of taking that asset and bringing it into the West, starting sort of phase 2B studies right away. Really unique opportunity here. Both higher potency and longer half-life are sort of the features relative to, you know, what is really a validated mechanism, you know, in those areas. And I think we're really just sort of scratching the surface as to how broad TSLP can be. Certainly the financing came together with a lot of enthusiasm from, you know, some great great co-investors with us, you know, Bain and RA and others. So yeah, it's an exciting deal. And certainly, you know, when you have later stage assets with real sort of best in class potential, you're seeing those kinds of financings get done. You know, a lot of the bigger financings here in 2023 have that profile, you know, rather than the, you know, shiny new platform story that may have been able to raise that kind of money in earlier in the cycle, for sure.
Yeah, it was an interesting deal. I saw some Isaac Stoner was saying something about how it's not a sign of a healthy ecosystem if you're raising these big rounds. But it sounds like what happened there was you guys actually de-risked it after putting a small amount of money in. And now there's bigger clinical studies to run. Is that the case? Bruce?
Yes, sorry. I was saying, yes, there was already clinical data on the molecule, you know, out of China. And really the small investment we made was really to secure the assets and develop the plan, put together a framework for what the clinical program would look like and how to finance it. The reality is you need a lot of capital to run large severe asthma studies, both in terms of numbers of patients and duration. So, you need a significant amount of capital to be able to power up a story like that.
Yeah, and make sure that the company's not focused on fundraising.
Exactly.
In this market. Yep. So also, OrbiMed announced $4.3 billion across its latest three funds.
Yeah.
I saw that.
I was going to say, it's great to see. You know, OrbiMed is a syndicate partner of many of us, a real friend of, you know, friend of the firm in terms of doing deals together. So great to see them reloading with a lot of dry powder. They simultaneously essentially closed three funds, the venture fund or the private investments fund, an Asia fund and a royalty fund all came together. You know, great, great to see. And these are, I forget the Roman numerals after all of these, but OrbiMed has obviously been around for a while and is very much a blue chip investor. You know, a couple of the things I thought were interesting in the few articles that I read, you know, 90% of the $4 billion was essentially covered by existing LPs. And so that number, I'd say, is pretty typical for a top tier firm in terms of LPs wanting to come back and, you know, stay in some of the existing winners that they have. The second thing, which I thought was more intriguing, was that the fundraise took over 12 months to complete. And you might say that's normal. I would say in the 2020, 2021 period of time, funds were definitely getting raised super fast. I think our fund, when we raised then, it was sort of 4 to 6 weeks and we were essentially done. And so, you know, the fact that it took a little over a year, at least according to this one article, if that is indeed the case, I'd say that probably reflects some hesitancy on the part of LPs in general about venture right now, as they're looking at the choppy market, in biotech as a whole, probably being a little bit more, you know, a little bit more cautious. Though in the end, with a firm like OrbiMed, it's hard not to participate if you're a large institutional LP.
Yeah, and speaking of kind of the markets, Roche, the deal that was announced this week about Roche acquiring Roivant subsidiary Telavant, which is a private company, for $7 billion upfront. I thought that was a really cool deal by Roivant, who formed Telavant as a joint venture with Pfizer last December. They invested $45 million for a 75% stake, and they're going to get about $5.2 billion of the upfront money, with Pfizer getting the rest of for its 25% stake in Telavant. There's also some milestone payments. But the head scratcher is that shares in Roivant closed down 14% on the day. Roivant CEO Matt Gline is a regular co-host, and he's going to join us next week and tell us more. But I'm curious to get Josh's thoughts, particularly on the stock reaction, and anybody else who wants to weigh in on that.
Can you hear me now?
We hear you.
All right. Sorry, I missed the first part. I was really hoping to hear everyone's comments, especially Paul's on general market trends. Great to have you as a guest, Paul. I haven't done this with you before. And a huge fan of your work. All right, so there is a bear market going on, and what happens in a bear market is you can almost not win. Almost every press release gets sold off, unless it's like just a tremendous, massive upside surprise. You know, it's a very tough tape to navigate in because biotech tends to be a very catalyst-driven sector. Hard to argue that deal for Roivant wasn't a spectacular one. That said, I think there were some high expectations heading into it. And so maybe, you know, once you throw some high expectations on top of a bear market, even just a phenomenal corporate update like that doesn't always get reflected in the stock. But we're seeing this over and over and over again. We haven't seen this in quite some time, this kind of a true bear tape where, you know, it's nearly impossible to power through you know, the headwinds from the macro setup. But, you know, on the other hand, there's been no bear tape that has completely killed biotech. You know, the sector thrives. It finds ways. If it needs to consolidate, it'll consolidate. If it needs to conserve capital, it'll conserve capital. The innovation is better than ever. And if you take a little bit of a longer-term focus, you know, when the stocks start to rebound, when we come out of the bear tape, they tend to rebound very, very fast. You can see stocks double in the course of a month, even without any obvious catalyst. So, you know, it's hard to time the bottom. It's hard to know, you know, when it's all going to turn around. But the one thing that we do know is that we've been here before, and those who were able to take advantage of it did unbelievably well in their portfolios, whereas, you know, others weren't so lucky in their ability to dodge and weave through the bullets of biotech bear market.
I'll quickly jump in and say, my guess is there's one additional element to this. Especially in this tape, I think some investors, when they see a deal like that, they prefer to see some kind of return of cash or like some type of announcement. If there's no announcement like that, like the number one thing that investors do not have right now, as you just described, Josh, is patience. And so people are worried that all of that money is just going to, you know, burn over years. And that may be a good thing. I mean, look at their track record of, you know, succeeding with investments. But as you described in this tape, like nobody gets a pass on patience for anything. So that might be a good question to ask Matt next week, like how they think about all that.
Yeah, I think there were also very high expectations. There were rumors earlier in the summer of, you know, double digit, you know, billions. And so this deal may have even though it's a fantastic deal, may have undershot some people's hugely inflated expectations.
Yeah, I was on a panel with Adam Koppel from Bain Capital, and he was talking about how the best wine comes from tough vines. And so, like, right now is one of those, tough times where there's just so much opportunity. So
is that actually true about wine? Is that actually true?
He says it is. Yeah, he was quoting somebody who's a wine expert, who's like one of their LPs or something like that.
I'm pretty sure that's just a marketing gimmick, so that when the grape yields are down, they can claim that the wine tastes better, but no one can really refute that, so they charge more. That's my Napa Valley conspiracy theory.
Okay. Anyway, so Brad, there was another big Series A this year, I guess 9 months ago. Cargos did a $200 million Series A, and they just announced they're filing for an IPO. Would love to get your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, so that was led by Third Rock and also Zontogeny, so congrats to Chris. I mean, this was just a filing, so we'll have to see if the IPO goes through. We all know how difficult it is out there. But this is a CAR-T company, and you know, they're trying to solve the problems that we're seeing. And it's an autologous company, and they're trying to solve like relapse problems that we're seeing with like the first round of CAR-T products. So they're going about it two ways. The first, like their lead program, just targets a different antigen than CD19. So it's a CD22, and they're developing it first in patients who have relapsed off of CD19 in the large B-cell lymphoma space. So that first problem that they're trying to solve is antigen escape. And I think what a lot of people are excited about is actually their second generation program that's trying to solve the same problem, but it's a tri-specific CAR. So it targets CD19, CD20, and CD22. And what I say all the time, like a way in like layman's terms to think about the transformation that the cell therapy field is going through right now is think of like the first generation of CAR-Ts is like a Swiss Army knife with one tool, CD19 essentially. And the exciting thing is with like cell engineering improving so much over the last handful of years and people using things like CRISPR and base editing and everything, it's going to, you know, they're already looking this way, but in the future, CAR T cells are going to be like Swiss Army knives with like a bunch of tools. And so that's an example of one that, you know, can hit three antigens. It's still a preclinical program, so we'll have to see that in practice. But I think that's pretty interesting. And the other problem that they're trying to solve besides antigen escape is you also lose in tumors some of the co-stimulatory signaling. So tumors tend to downregulate things like CD58. And so this company is trying to induce CD2 co-stim signaling. So, you know, at least it's, at least they're trying, you know, it's not just like a me too that's going into a crowded space. Like the whole idea behind their programs is to solve the problems that we're seeing clinically in the first round. And so I think that's probably why they've had such luck in the private markets and maybe have a chance to go public, you know, pretty soon after this filing, because the CAR T space, there's been so many CD19 programs and it has been crowded, but they're going about it a little bit of a different way.
Yeah. So we're going to go to Don in a moment, but I wanted, before we do that, I wanted to hear from you, Paul. You were at CTAD, which is a clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease conference in Boston this week. What were the biggest takeaways?
Sure. Yeah, thanks so much. So the biggest data that came out was for the lecanemab subcutaneous administration. And then Josh, and thank you, Josh, for the kind words, man. Totally feelings mutual, and congrats on your move. Josh highlighted in our email thread on the Roche Brain Shuttle program. On the lecanemab sub-Q data, it was really interesting because the overhang on Biogen on these data, and I guess I don't cover Eisai, but you know, certainly they're 50-50, was this overarching question whether you could recapitulate the potency of an IV via sub-Q and whether Cmax, which would always be higher with an IV, was important for efficacy. And these data were almost backwards from expectations. The sub-Q looks like it's slightly more efficacious on plaque lowering, but it actually had a higher rate of ARIA, which was unexpected because ARIA was thought to be Cmax mediated. I mean, I think the general, ultimately for Biogen, it's still a win because I think the converse of the other expectation was, you know, or the fear was that, you know, maybe this was not going to be good enough to get regulatory approval for treatment naive patients. You might only get maintenance. So from that perspective, it's a positive. Of course, in line with the theme that we've been talking about today, Biogen stock was up in the aftermarket and then traded down. And I think, again, it's this market and it's this issue with stocks where investors don't have a sense of urgency, where for Biogen, you know, the view is still that the launch is early. It's going to start out slow. The sub-Q is not coming on the market, assuming approval, until probably late next year or 2025. So do you really have to be there? But the other interesting piece of this is just kind of the implications for the space, because for other earlier stage companies, you know, subcutaneous administration has been looked at as a potential path to differentiation, not just on dosing convenience, which can broaden access, but also possibly on safety. And so this is new information related to the pharmacokinetic drivers of ARIA that has implications for other companies in the space. You know, we'll get data from Prothena soon and we'll see if their data fits with this or tells a different story. And then the other interesting thing was this brain shuttle data, which I want to get Josh's perspective on. I mean, our view, just at a high level, is that it looks really cool. I mean, they're showing, you know, good potency. The ARIA rate is mysteriously low, and I think our team has been trying to grapple with what's driving that, because, look, the dose is a lot lower. They're essentially using transferrin receptor to improve the uptake of an antibody in the brain, but the brain exposure really shouldn't be ultimately that different, right? You know, the peripheral exposure shouldn't be the driver of ARIA. So that's a little bit puzzling to us. And then I think the other question with this approach is, you know, what is it going to look like on safety? Transferrin receptors involved in iron trafficking, anemia. Can you avoid that if you have an antibody that still has effector function? So still a lot of questions, but the initial read on that data is super, super interesting. I don't know, Josh, if you wanted to add anything there.
Yeah, well, if you follow Denali, they have a similar, arguably much more advanced technology. They call it transport vehicle instead of brain shuttle. But it's the same concept. They've been working on it for some time, and I think you could argue they've got the leading platform. And their data for Hunter syndrome, you know, which a few months ago showed, you know, not just the apparent ability to get into the brain, but the ability to lower neurofilament levels in a way that, you know, traditional enzyme replacement therapy for that disease has just never been able to do. I think if you look at the brain shuttle gantenerumab data from Roche in that light, it takes on like a lot more meaning. To Paul's point, like it's early, and so, you know, you can't get overly excited about that, the disconnect or what you, for, between what you might have expected for the amyloid effect in the area. But, you know, if the thesis is that ARIA is a vasculature event, and, you know, you gotta flood the vasculature with antibody to get it into the CNS, kind of without the help of a brain shuttle approach, you know, you could rationalize what you're seeing with that data from Roche and kind of explain it and accept it as something that looks, you know, early, but very exciting. It looks like Roche had some anemia signals, not a hard signal, a soft signal. I don't think Denali's seen that with their technology. And so, you know, as we're trying to figure out who's got the technology edge, who's got the product edge, a lot still to learn, but definitely got a lot of calls on Denali because they have a partnership with Biogen, right, flying their own brain shuttle, their transport vehicle approach to beta amyloid. Just one other thing to mention is that, you know, if you look at these patients, you know, that this is modestly slowing disease progression, these drugs, obviously very important, but we're far from kind of reaching the true goal of therapy. So we got to be thinking about other targets. I know there's some interest in tau as a target, which is interesting. There's some advanced approaches there. Personally, I find the TREM2 biology and connection to Alzheimer's absolutely fascinating. There are a couple of companies advancing TREM2 agonists that really excited to see how they evolve.
Yeah, Josh, if I could chime in really quickly, Daphne. There was some tau data at CTAD for this Biogen Iotis antisense oligonucleotide. And what's intriguing about that program is a few antibodies have already failed in the tau space in Alzheimer's, but tau, unlike amyloid, is an intracellular target, or at least predominantly intracellular. So it's possible that the ASO approach might have the advantage there if you can get the biodistribution right. And then, yeah, to Josh's point, we're watching TREM2 closely as well. It has some similar genetic support that is kind of like APOE4 in that it's a risk factor, and there's a big readout later next year from AbbVie and Alector. So definitely something to watch.
Yeah, I also saw that CMS is expanding Medicare coverage to include access to PET scans for Alzheimer's disease patients. And I was curious what your thoughts are in general on this concept of early, you know, being able to access these patients earlier, whether it be, you know, through expanded access here for PET scans, but also blood tests and other approaches to identify patients earlier.
The blood-based biomarkers are huge. I mean, everyone in the space is saying that. There's a lot of investment. We've done I'm so far from a diagnostics expert, but we've spent a little bit of time looking across these, and it seems like there's just a lot of work going into it, and someone's going to figure it out, but it's hard to really know, again, from my non-expert seat, what horse to bet on. You know, PET scans getting reimbursed, look, that's great, right? I mean, I think one of the questions with this class has been, when you've got PET scans, you've got MRIs, who's paying for what goes back to the patient. So PET scans getting reimbursed is great, but you're still probably going to be doing PET scans on patients that are symptomatic, right? Because that's how they kind of got there in the first place, unless there's this extremely strong family history. So the blood-based biomarker stuff is super important, but unfortunately, I think it's hard to make a call exactly on the timing there right now.
Yeah, super interesting. So we'll zoom out for a little bit to talk about the industry, and then we'll come back to a bunch of data and other sort of news from the week. Dawn, this week, Bernie Sanders requested an investigation into an NIH proposal. And it was like this big, there was a big article about it. And to me, the whole thing just showed what a real lack of understanding there is of the industry, including things like typical NIH licensing practices. What did you think about this? And then maybe you could also talk about the state of prior authorization processes.
Sure. So I kind of thought, you know, Bernie's going to Bernie, right? It's very, like, kind of pretty odd brand. There's not like a lot of new stuff here. I think some of the misconception, I think that the article that, you know, is perhaps a bit sensational in some of its, in this way they presented some of the, facts of the case, if you will. So the kind of the net story is that there's a PI from the NIH who formed a company and is proceeding to obtain a license for a program that he worked on that is looking at PCRs for cancers caused by HPV. And it seems like perhaps Gilead and Kite were involved before, maybe they passed. And so being, you know, believer in his science, he wanted to do it himself. That's kind of how I read it. And a couple of things that Senator Sanders took an issue with is that it's an exclusive license, which was strange because I think all licenses are typically exclusive licenses, because why else would you take a unless it's a platform, unless it's a tools company or something like that, or a tools patent, where a non-exclusive license wouldn't really matter. And you just, you know, you want to be able to use that for your own discovery or research. You know, typically any composition of matter patent is going to, or, you know, things around drugs are definitely going to be exclusive licenses. And so they make a big deal about that. And Senator Sanders, you know, is quoted in the article of that, you know, basically you should have non-exclusive licenses so that you can decrease the cost of the drug. And, you know, you're kind of getting really, it's all centered around drug pricing. Like, why should the, you know, should an individual like this PI who's spinning this out of the NIH potentially should have benefit financially from this and on the expense of patients. That's kind of the overall theme. And I do think you're right, Daphne, that it just, you know, it's such a uninformed view of how licensing process works, either through the NIH or through academia, how drug development actually works, and the role of the private public partnership that can be very beneficial in bringing products to market. And then, you know, the potential value, you know, of this medicine. I mean, this is going to be for, you know, it's right now the patent is for HPV-derived cancers. I'm not sure, you know, what the breadth of its application might be in cancer patients more broadly. I'm not an expert in that. But yeah, I thought the whole thing was a little bit too sensationalized and quite on brand for Senator Sanders, but I didn't really see much new here. I'm curious what others think about that.
He has some interesting ideas. He had another idea about basically abolishing patents and doing some sort of a prize-based system for drug development. So I think, you know, that he's one that I'm looking forward to at some point sitting down with and talking to. Bruce, do you have any thoughts on this? Sorry.
I was going to say, I mean, I think he's a self-proclaimed socialist, right? He just doesn't believe that capitalism is the way to go for something like this. And I fundamentally disagree. I think capitalism actually is the way to go here. And I'm not sure, you know, his ideas, I try to keep an open mind, Daphne, you're better than I am. I would keep an open mind, I think.
Does anybody else want to comment on this, Bruce, or anybody? No? All right. Do you want to talk about that other story?
Yeah, so building on what you were talking about in your time in Washington around the bad behavior of PBMs, there's been a really sad and compelling article in JAMA this week around the impact of prior authorization in cancer patients and the stress and the negative outcomes that it causes patients. And I guess it's like not surprising, but it's nice to see it published in a peer-reviewed, respected journal, and with the rigor that the investigators did the study. So they looked at fielded a questionnaire amongst 178 patients undergoing cancer care. This is coming from the Memorial Sloan Kettering investigators. And they found that there is a really high degree of patients who have delays to care due to prior authorization processes from their insurance company. Most, if there were delays, which I think two-thirds of patients did report some type of delay, those delays are typically more than 2 weeks. And so we don't have outcomes to the cancer treatment itself, but the outcomes that we do have are patient-reported outcomes of increased anxiety and patient administrative burden. So the patients themselves are having to be involved in calling insurance companies and managing the paperwork and managing the coverage of their medicines and while they're dealing with a cancer diagnosis. I think this is just egregious. I mean, I understand the need to control cost by the insurance companies, but there needs to be, I think, some accountability to amongst the insurance plans to make this process a better experience for the patients. Most of the patients reported the experience was either horrible or bad in dealing with this with the insurance companies and getting this coverage, which is not unexpected and certainly understandable.
Yeah, it's frustrating. We finally get new medicines to patients and then have those kinds of delays. So I'm going to move to Brad. Brad, there was a couple of topics that I'd love to get your thoughts on. One of them was this $350 million deal between BMS and Lian Bio. And the other was this the disappointing update from Novartis's phase 3 trial of Pluvicto.
Yeah. So on Leo, I should say full disclosure, the chairman is a good friend of mine. So this is a company that it's basically was spun out of Perceptive. And the idea was to, work with U.S. companies to license drugs for China. And really their crown jewel, I would say, all along has been mavacamten. So this is the MyoKardia drug. It's a cardiac myosin inhibitor. And it's approved for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in the West. And they licensed that from MyoKardia at the time for $40 million, which was, really well timed. And then later on, Bristol comes along and buys MyoKardia for $13 billion. And so, I think if you invest that much in an asset, having global rights and, including Asia, which is, an ever more important commercial market for large companies, really makes sense. So, Lian, I think, did a pretty good job of developing this drug in China, and they actually filed for approval in April. So it's under review with the NMPA there. And there's actually a couple other Asian countries that fall under this deal, Singapore, Thailand, things like that. But Apple has bought this back for $350 million. And also, Lian won't owe them, you know, certain milestones on approval and everything. So the financial benefit's actually a little bit bigger than that. But the big question now is, what happens to Lian? You know, as important as the commercial market in China is, the sentiment around it today compared to if you were talking to people 3 or 4 years ago is a lot different due to drug pricing. And Lian still has like a few programs in their portfolio, for example, nanobiotics. That's like a nanoparticle that's meant to improve radiation. I've actually done a couple interviews with them for Biotech TV. They also have a SHP2 that's, you know, really an out of favor target right now in oncology. The initial human data on that hasn't been so strong. And they also have a TKI that's a FGFR1/3. And so they announced, when they announced this deal with Bristol, in addition to having the cash, that they're going to do a strategic review and give an update on that sometime early next year. So we'll have to see what, you know, happens with Lian. And then the
can I just ask you a question on this? Because I know you've been following the China space so closely. What do you think happened there? You mentioned the consideration of pricing, which shouldn't necessarily be a new consideration. Like, we've always known prices in China is a fraction of what it is in the U.S. Like, did something change? Were the expectations just too high? Or what's your take in terms of why the sentiment on China investment seems to have come in as much as it has?
Yeah, the pricing, so that was always like a risk. And I would say that it has, the reality of it over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, every year China goes through this negotiation. And everyone expected that to be difficult, but it's actually been, I would say, worse than the worst case scenario. I mean, PD-1s, for example, some of these PD-1s are getting like $5,000 a year. You know, the list price here is like $130K. And so like people expected, you know, not Western prices, obviously, but it's actually turned out to be worse than the worst case scenario. And so China companies, like a big trend over the last 2 or 3 years, as this has become apparent, have really accelerated their global plans. And if you talk with China companies privately, their business model revolves around, you know, territories outside of China, of course, the US and Europe. And so with Lian, they're kind of in a tough position because their whole purpose in life is to commercialize drugs in China and only China and, you know, some of the surrounding countries. And so they're affected more than others by, you know, pricing turning out to be worse than the worst case scenario. And so that's why they've, you know, had a negative enterprise value and been pretty out of favor until they announced this deal. So, yeah, I would say, like, you know, people always, you know, knew that that was a risk, but it's actually turned out to be worse than, you know, even like the, you know, the toughest projections if we were talking a handful of years ago. And then, real quick, I'll go over to Pluvicto. So, I mean, I guess this is bad news, but like, I think this is going to turn out fine. So this is the radiopharmaceutical that Novartis has for prostate cancer that targets PSMA. And it's a really important drug because it's, I mean, the best way to think of it is it's going to be like the first really blockbuster radiopharmaceutical. You know, prostate cancer is obviously a huge indication. And to me, it's like a landmark drug for the field. And just like ADCs are going through, you know, arguably like an inflection point or renaissance or whatever you want to say, like, you know, if you followed ESMO, you saw that ADCs were really the star of the show. Radiopharmaceuticals are going through like a similar thing. So this is already approved in prostate cancer in the post-taxane setting. And they're trying to move it up into earlier lines of treatment. And so their ESMO data is in the pre-taxane setting. And the thing that like is the real head scratcher here I don't know that I've really ever seen this like many times before, if ever. Their PFS data was spectacular. So it's 12 months versus 5.6 months, and the hazard ratio was 0.041. So, you know, anytime you have a hazard ratio below 0.5, it's like, take a picture, take your hat off, like, congratulations. And amazingly, the news from last week is that the overall survival data is the exact opposite. It's not mature yet, but the hazard ratio is like 1.16. So that means, you know, at the moment, you've got to wonder if like the drug group is actually doing worse. But the reason why I don't think this is an issue and they'll figure it out, it's because almost all the patients crossed over here. And that's a sign of like how important of a drug this is. And so it's just totally confounded by all of that. So this was a second interim analysis. So, you know, the fact that the overall survival is actually looking worse right now means that it's not going to get approved, you know, right away in this setting. And so they're going to have to let more data mature and file at a later date. So I would view this more as a delay than some sign that this drug isn't working. I think at the end of the day, if they let this mature more and they kind of look at the statistics and numbers about this and, you know, really analyze like how that crossover affected everything, I think it would be truly shocking if that hazard ratio stayed above one when the PFS looks so good. I mean, it just, that doesn't really make any sense at all, but we'll have to see.
That's really interesting. It's good to dig behind sort of the headlines and get your thoughts on that one. Paul, you were at the World Sleep meeting last weekend. It sounds like everyone was talking about the new orexin 2 agonist class. Do you want to say more about that?
I can't say that I was there because that was in Brazil and CTED was in Boston. But I did follow it closely, and Alkermes had their earning call this week, and their data was pretty interesting. I can be quick because I know we have more topics to get through. This is a really interesting new class of sleep, I guess functionally wakefulness drug so far. We'll see if they have an impact on sleep. The initial data has been in narcolepsy type 1 patients, where there's this really strong biological rationale because NT1 seems to be at least partially, maybe mostly driven by orexin deficiency. You know, again, I don't want to just kind of hammer home the bearish theme about this market, but, you know, Alkermes had data that looks like their molecule is super active, looks like there might be a therapeutic index, at least on liver tox, which has been the historical issue, given how low their dose is, but the stock traded off. And I think the stock traded off because there are some super interesting biological questions that are outstanding with this class. So essentially what we're seeing from these orexins is that you get this profound impact on wakefulness to the point that, you know, narcolepsy, where patients can spontaneously go right into REM sleep, at their highest dose, 3 out of 4 patients reported insomnia, which is, it's sort of incredible. When we've talked to key opinion leaders in this space, you know, one of the theoretical concerns that's been raised is, are these drugs too potent? And orexin follows a circadian rhythm where the levels of it slope down steeply in the evening and almost disinhibit your sleep drive, I think. I'm probably oversimplifying. And so the question is really, can you recapitulate that with a small molecule drug? Their half-life, you know, in the 10 to 12 hour range looks theoretically ideal, but again, this is very closely regulated in healthy individuals. And so that's kind of the overarching question going forward. There's also a number of other side effects because, you know, you see this urinary frequency side effect, dizziness, other normal CNS side effects. So it's early, but super interesting. And the big event in this space is Takeda is going to have phase 2 data from their compound next year. You know, the narcolepsy space is a big market. Jazz dominates it right now. But there is still some unmet need. So it's kind of a wait and see as we get more data. But for Alkermes, this is important for them because, you know, Alkermes, I think perception wise has always been kind of seen as this in between as a spec pharma versus a biotech company, right? I mean, they have multiple proprietary products, but, you know, they tend to be leveraging proven mechanisms. You know, this is a true NCE, true novel biology. you know, really cool science, but certainly something that's a challenging drug development problem as well.
And Paul, I'm not as close to the space. Is the expectation here that whoever gets a clean orexin that has, you know, the right PK profile will take the market from the oxybates, or is there going to be any role for oxybates after this? And do you know if the orexins are going to go after kind of the idiopathic hypersomnia market, or is that where the oxybate shift and then the orexins come in on narcolepsy?
Yeah, it's a great question, Josh. So I think we don't know if these drugs will be best suited as a monotherapy or if they'll still need an oxybate, right? Because, you know, the oxybates, for all the kind of criticism of that class, I mean, they're pretty incredible in terms of the benefit on sleep. When you look at the data, and, you know, I look at a lot of CNS trials for drugs of small effect sizes, I think the oxybate data shows that over 70 patients report being much or very much improved. I mean, you don't see that with like an antidepressant, right? So unseating that is hard, right? You know, you really need a drug that not just works on wakefulness, but truly makes patients feel better at their core. And I think with orexin, you know, we haven't seen any sleep data yet, right? And we have seen this insomnia side effect. So whether or not they can be a mono or a combo and whether there's a TI, that's a question. And I think, Josh, to your point on the competitive side, I mean, Alkermes is competing with Takeda, and then Jazz is there and Centessa is there. So it's early days on that. There is pursuit of this class in NT2 and IH. The mechanistic rationale isn't as strong. You may need to push the dose higher. And then there are questions around the TI. So it's still early days there. There's some initial data from an older Takeda molecule just looking at wakefulness in one day in NT2, IH, and obstructive sleep apnea that, again, it looks really potent, but it's all single dose data. So it's still somewhat TBD.
So Josh, you had a bunch of updates, data, things that you're tracking. Let's say you have about 5 minutes to go through as many of those as you want, and then we should do some closing remarks.
Yeah, so we had a little bit of a rains or pours scenario with PTC Therapeutics on the third quarter earnings call. They got like hit multiple times by the FDA, first asking them to run a 26-week non-clinical mouse study for their PKU chaperone drug, Cipla. Which is, it actually looks much better than Kuvan. It looks like it could be a real player in the PKU space, but they've now had to kick back that filing to the third quarter of next year. The FDA even dinged them on the compatibility of the trial versus commercial material for their AADC gene therapy product. That looks like another really exciting therapeutic. It's a very ultra orphan type indication, but the efficacy profile of that drug is pretty off the charts from what I can tell. It looks to me like maybe there's like a little delay in at least getting IND clearance for the Huntington splice modular program. So there's like a whole bunch of little things that at a time where you don't want even one thing, and the stock's been getting hit today. It's down like a little over 20%. So on the gene therapy theme, to highlight one really interesting update that, you know, that's not really relevant for Regeneron so much as it is for the gene therapy field, they reported that the Decibel gene therapy otoferlin program for severe hearing loss and certain genetic causes of that, they had one very, very young patient who was treated and seemed to respond favorably with some of the auditory measures that one performs in kids who can't really verbalize. So that's a nice move for the gene therapy field. Another one, at least early, but I feel like we've kind of gone from trying to throw everything against the wall in gene therapy and starting to figure out what's sticking. You know, what's sticking are gene therapies targeting the heart. We've got some intravitreal gene therapy success for wet AMD. You know, liver targeting gene therapy seems to be emerging. So we're starting to establish some order in the gene therapy space, which I think's you know, makes it a much more compelling space to come back to now. In the can't win camp, Catalyst Pharma got FDA approval of a Agamree for Duchenne. Somehow they've been able to kind of sneak ahead of a PTC, or I should say alongside PTC with their Translarna approach, which is also a steroid approach for Duchenne's. You know, but Catalyst Pharma, also trading down today in one of those you just can't win kind of tapes. I'm not sure everyone was expecting this. This is an asset they acquired from Santhera back in July for a fairly modest amount. So I don't think they've disclosed pricing. We'll have to see where that one fits in, but obviously still very high in the need in Duchenne's. And right now everyone's waiting for the one big catalyst in biotech before the end of the year, and it's the phase 3 Sarepta Roche gene therapy Duchenne data. That's, you know, if there was one big thing left to watch for, that's going to be it. You know, another company and product that I've been watching is this company, ESSA. The ticker's EPIX, E-P-I-X, but the company's name is ESSA, just the legacy thing there. And so they have an androgen receptor inhibitor that targets a novel site of the androgen receptor and may kind of supplement traditional androgen receptors like enzalutamide. And they gave a phase 1-2 data update. It's looking good. Like, they're getting PSA 90 responses around 80%. That looks like above even where J&J's apalutamide hit in one of its trials. They were like 70%, Xtandi was 60%. And to be clear, this is ESSA combining on top of enzalutamide. So an uncontrolled data set, but nonetheless, a pretty provocative one for the mechanism, and seemingly differentiated from what enzalutamide might have been able to do alone. But again, no love in this kind of a tape. Like, it's just very, very hard to see anything go up. And then last thing to flag and kind of get curious to get everyone's thought on this is that Insmed provided a blinded interim data of their TPIP, basically their inhaled treprostinil unique formulation that's supposed to be longer lasting and a potentially once a day product. Blinded analysis, but seemed like they were getting very good PVR, peripheral vascular resistance reductions in PAH. That's kind of one of the most reliable, one of the least noisy markers of disease. The fact that they're seeing such a meaningful reduction is actually fairly impressive. Again, despite that update, Insmed traded down on the news because that's just the kind of tip.
Josh, why did they give that?
Well, that's kind of, I think they had promised they would give it, and there's this trend of, like, you know, giving blinded looks either, you know, under CDAs with investors or for broader audiences. Like, I don't know. It always seems like you're tempting fate a little bit. It helps create news flow. It helps create milestones along the way. I don't know. Like, I'm kind of mixed on its utility. The more we know, the better, right? Like, you can't complain about having too much information. But I know these kind of blinded interims get criticized, maybe in part because they seem to not work out more often than they do, and they seem to perhaps mislead often than they do inform. But, you know, that's up to investors to decide. That's up for us to figure out, like, how much credence to put on a blinded interim. So I'm a little curious if anyone else has thoughts on that general practice.
I think it's not a great trend.
Well, I'll just say it's also totally unfair that some investors get a blinded look and others don't. And in a market right now where generalists have, like, totally are totally gone from the biotech sector, you know, to have things going on like that, that give the appearance that it's not a level playing field for everyone, I think hurts the whole sector because it makes it look like, you know, some companies are rigged in that way. So I think the optics of it are pretty bad as well.
Yeah, I see a lot more downside than upside from this. But to
Insmed's credit, you know, they did this in a public forum, not in a CDA kind of behind closed doors. I think that's where the optics get particularly frustrating. To their credit, they laid it out for everyone to make up their own minds. You know, but maybe they just laid it out in the wrong biotech tape.
Well, I kind of like it because I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, I'm not a drug developer, so maybe I can't appreciate some of the downsides, but I feel like everyone's looking at blinded data and trying to figure out things from it internally, even if, you know, some companies say they don't. So I sort of commend them for being so transparent.
Yeah, I just think that blinded data can often be misleading. And so, you know, I think the one thing you can learn, it's sometimes safety, I think, is the one area where I think it's really positive to get some blood, you know, some information blinded. But I see downside in that if you create expectations, as Josh was saying, and you don't then live up to them later, that could be a problem. So one area I thought was really interesting this week as well is, you know, after these acquisitions, reading the proxies, And the one that I thought was really odd and was Mirati Therapeutics. And, you know, they talked about Bristol-Myers Squibb acquisition. You know, we know that they were, BMS announced they would acquire Mirati for $4.8 billion. The thing that was really interesting was that in March 2022, they offered almost twice, I mean, actually even more than twice that. You know, the idea that you're negotiating for a year to get half the amount, I think was a lot of investors were probably kind of interested in that and annoyed by that. But I always think these proxies tell you so much about the process. Like sometimes you get companies bidding against themselves. Just really interesting to read those. So we're almost at time. I'd love to invite everybody just to go around and make any closing remarks. Paul, it's been great to have you here this week. And thank you to all of the guest co-hosts today. Anybody would like to make some closing remarks before we end the show?
Yeah, I would just say that the bearish sentiment aside, it's hard not to be excited about some of the things happening in, you know, Alzheimer's, obesity, you know, all of these other, you know, wonderful bits of data news and cancer. Hard not to be excited about the impact the sector's having on patients, even if the markets aren't giving us any credit for it.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. And, you know, I think so many areas that are making progress for patients, it's really an exciting time from a patient perspective. So thank you, everyone, for joining us today. I hope you all have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week on Biotech Hangout.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Paul.